I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of The Brett Johnson Show. Today's episode is episode number 75, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy and Turning Your Life Around, when we come back. All right, so we are back to today's episode of The Brett Johnson Show, episode number 75, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy and Turning Your Life Around. So here's the deal. I was arrested September 16th, 2006. That's after I had initially been arrested, had been hired by the United States Secret Service to be an informant and a consultant, had screwed over the United States Secret Service over the space of about 10 months, at which point they found out about that. I took off on a cross-country crime spree, stole $600,000 in the space of 4 months. I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada. The night before, I had stolen $160,000 out of ATMs. I woke up the next morning, signed on to cartersmarket.com, which was ran by Max Butler at that point in time. And there is my name, U.S. Most Wanted, beside of it. Now, you guys who have heard me speak before, you know that I say that, you know, that there are things in life known as aha moments. And this was not an aha moment. This was more of an type moment. So I did what any normal person would do. I loaded up and I went to Disney World. Got arrested after the space of several weeks. They used a stingray. Back then they were called triggerfish, but they were used a stingray device to locate me. Came and got me, arrested me, sent me to prison, and then I escaped prison. Now, here's why this show, this is how this story is leading into today's episode of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy and Turning Your Life Around. So when I was arrested in Orlando, Florida, I was housed, that's what they call it when they throw you in a county jail. I was housed at the Orange County Detention Center and the Federal Holding Unit. And brand new to this stuff. I had spent 3 or 4 months in a county jail in Charleston, South Carolina, and Columbia, South Carolina. But I hadn't really spent any time housed with other federal inmates. They just mixed everyone together in South Carolina. So I'm there, and this guy who went by the name of Yeti, he had this long white hair, long white beard. He was in for meth charges. This guy named Yeti, he kind of takes me in under his wing. And that's been kind of the story of my prison tenure, is I always was very fortunate that someone was there to take me in under their wing, to teach me how to quote unquote jail. So Yeti, we're talking one day and he's like, hey, Brett, you know, the only time you get off in federal prison is the drug program. And I looked at Yeti and I was like, Yeti, I don't use drugs. And he was like, well, Brett, you could find a drug problem, can't you? And I was like, you know, Yeti, I can find a drug problem. So the feds were very kind to me. They gave me this stuff called diesel therapy. So when they're really pissed off at you, so I was arrested in Orlando, Florida. I was being transported from Orlando back to Columbia, South Carolina. Diesel therapy, what that is it as they're transporting you, they put you on a van. And as they're transporting you, you stop at every single county jail that you possibly can. You go in and you get processed. Process takes a minimum of 4 hours. Sometimes it takes 6, 8, 9 hours. You get processed, hit your bunk. A couple hours after you hit your bunk, hey, pack your shit. It's time to move again. And then you stop at the next county jail and you bang, 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 bang. Well, it took me over 2 weeks to get from Orlando, Florida, back to Columbia, South Carolina. And every place I stopped, as they're processing you, you know, the intake, as they're processing you, they ask you, they give you a form as well. Are you using any type of drugs? And I just marked, yes, I'm using drugs. And they ask you, what type are you using? I'm like, well, alcohol and cocaine. So by the time I get to Columbia, South Carolina, I've got a paper trail of requests of saying I'm an addict and an alcoholic, and requesting help for my serious condition. Now, when I got to Columbia, South Carolina, my lawyer, my initial lawyer, was a gentleman by the name of Paul Thurmond. his father, his name was Strom Thurmond. Strom Thurmond was this deep South, South Carolina senator who his claim to fame at one point, he had the longest filibuster in history. That was Strom Thurmond. Paul was his son. So I had paid Paul a shitload of money to be my attorney. The feds found out, of course, that I paid Paul with illegal funds. Turns out that you can't pay an attorney with money that you've stolen. So they make me drop him, and they give me this guy named Jimmy P. Rogers. And Jimmy Rogers looked exactly, and I mean exactly, like Billy D. Williams, you know, Lando Calrissian. He looked exactly like Billy D. Williams from those malt liquor commercials. So I'm going to tell you now, the only good thing that Jimmy Rogers ever did for me, at my arraignment, they're up there, they're testifying, and Jimmy Rogers stands up and he's like, "Your Honor, will you order a psychological evaluation for Mr. Johnson?" And the judge agreed to that. So the psychological evaluation, I was at the county jail in Lexington, South Carolina. It's right outside of Columbia. I was at the county jail there. Psychologist comes in. It's a 4-hour interview. About halfway through the interview, psychologist looks at me and he was like, "Use any type of drugs?" And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "What do you use?" I'm like, "I use cocaine." "Smoke or snort?" "Snort." "How much do you snort?" "An 8-ball a day." And he looks at me and he's like, "That's a lot." And I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Do you have any problems out of that?" And I looked at him and I said, "Yes, I can't get an erection." And he looks at me and I looked at him and we were silent. And I'm going to tell you, I got that from watching the movie Boogie Nights. That end scene where Mark Wahlberg, he snorted so much cocaine that he can no longer stand to attention. And that large prosthetic member, that because it's fake, I found out later, that's not his real Johnson that's between his legs. It was a fake one, but it's limp. It's just dangling. So I got that movie from Boogie. I got that idea from Boogie Nights. I was like, "Hey, that's got to be real, right?" So the psychologist is looking at me. I'm looking at him. And finally, I broke the ice. I looked at him. And I was like, "Is that right?" And the psychologist looks at me. And he's like, "It could happen." And then he looks at me. He's like, "Is it still happening now?" And he kind of scowls at me a little bit. And I was like, "No, it's working fine. Not that I need it to work where I am right now." Well, that makes it into my PSR, pre-sentence report. The probation office and the prosecutor's office, before you get sentenced to federal prison, they do an in-depth background check of you. And then they recommend to the judge in the report how much prison time that judge should give you. And my thing was 60 to 75 months. And inside of the PSR was the stuff about that drug problem that I've got where I couldn't get it up. So the day of my sentencing, the prosecutor, he's standing up and he's literally screaming, top of his lungs in the courtroom, "Mr. Johnson has manipulated the prosecutor. He's manipulated the Secret Service," and he points at the judge, "and he's manipulated you today, Your Honor. We insist on the upper limits of the guidelines." The judge looks at me and she was like, "I agree, 75 months. Well, I had already told everyone that was within earshot in my cell and my unit that I was not going to stay if they gave me any more than 60 months. So sentence is 75. I looked at my lawyer and I was like, "Can you get the drug program for me?" My lawyer's like, "I don't know. I'll ask." He stands up. He asks the judge, "Will you order the drug program for Mr. Johnson?" The judge, Judge Curry, looks at me and she says, "No, but I'll recommend he gets evaluated for it." I looked at my lawyer. "What does that mean?" My lawyer's like, "Well, you're probably not going to get it." I looked at my lawyer again and I was like, "Look, how soon can you get me to the camp?" My lawyer looks at me and is like, "Well, if you don't appeal, I can get you there pretty quick." And my exact words were, "Fuck the appeal. Get me to the camp. I'll take it from there." He looks at me like I'm the biggest idiot in the world because he knows what time it is. They don't appeal. 6 weeks later, I pull up on a prison bus to Ashland, Kentucky, the camp there, the minimum security prison camp. I had had family and friends research which camp was not supposed to have fences on it. It said Ashland did not have a fence around that prison. However, when I pulled up there, there was a 14-foot fence with razor wire on top. And I looked at it and I was like, I can't climb that son of a bitch. So I walked in, going through processing. As I'm going through processing, I start talking to the guard. And I asked the guard, I was like, hey, are there any jobs outside of the fence? And he looks at me and he was like, well, you can work in the National Forest. And I was like, no, I'll die out there. And then he's like, well, you can work at landscaping. And I'm like, well, I can run a weed eater. So I got a job at landscaping, job outside of the fence. Lasted about 6 weeks at the prison camp, and then I escaped. Lasted about three, 4 weeks on the lam, on the escape, until the U.S. Marshals found me holed up in a hotel, at which point I served eight months in solitary confinement. And at the sentencing for the escape, what happens is Secret Service is there, prosecutor is there, my lawyer, the judge. Now, this time it's not in South Carolina. This time it's in Kentucky. So as I'm getting ready to get sentenced, the prosecutor stands up and he looks at the judge and he was like, Your Honor, we would appreciate it if you would take into consideration that when Mr. Johnson was arrested this time, he was found with prepaid debit cards, with lists of identities, with a laptop, and it looks like he was engaged in tax return identity theft yet again. The judge looks at him and says, no. If you were going to charge them with that, you should have charged them with that. Then he looks at me and he was like, Mr. Johnson, I have no idea why you did the things you've done. But by you keeping your mouth shut right now, it looks like you're saving yourself a very serious charge. And I looked at the judge and I was like, yes, Your Honor. And then he looks at me and he's going through the PSR. Now, the PSR had the drug problem in the first one from South Carolina. Because I escaped so quickly, they used the exact same PSR again. So he's going through that PSR. He hits the drug stuff and he says, it also looks like before you got involved with all these drugs, that you were a pretty good citizen. And I was like, yes, Your Honor. And then he says, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you 15 extra months of prison time for the escape. But I'm going to order the drug program for you. And I was like, yes, Your Honor. So here's the way the drug program works. The drug program, you get up to 12 months off. So you get a year off of your prison sentence, plus you get an additional 6 months halfway house. So you actually get out of prison, if you get all the time, you get out of prison 18 months earlier than you would have. Now, I got sentenced to 15 months. I got 18 months off. So by escaping prison, and I'm not proud of this, but by escaping prison, I saved 3 months off of my prison sentence. Now, that is not the point of this story. Here's the point. The drug program, it's called RDAP. It's the Residential Drug Abuse Program. All right. I lied my way into that program. Now, I was expecting that program to be all about rehabilitating someone from drug use. Here's the thing. I have never, up until I was 34, I didn't drink. When I became 34, I drank, and I liked drinking, and today, I like some alcohol as well. As a matter of fact, I'm not saying there's anything in this cup, but it's a little late at night right now, and I had some Malibu in the cabinet and some pineapple juice and some Midori. And I'm not saying it's in here, but I am saying that I'm not saying it's not in there. I like alcohol every now and then. I've never used drugs in my life. I've smoked, when I say that, I've smoked like 4 or 5 joints. I did inhale the marijuana, but I would lose track of time. And I don't like that. I'm the son of a bitch because of my childhood, because of the abuse that I went through and everything. I'm the son of a bitch that does not like to lose control. I want to be in control of the situation and control of my faculties at all times. All right. So it's when I do drink, and I drink very rarely, but when I do, I drink typically 4 or 5 times a year. I enjoy a bottle of champagne. That's what I actually drink. But when I do drink, I enjoy that, but it's not very common at all. So I lied to get in the drug program to get the time off. I was very fortunate that I got in that drug program. And to be honest with you, it's the best lie that I have probably ever told in my life, as far as it being beneficial to me and to anyone that I think that I encounter these days, because I'm no longer that person that's out there committing crime. So RDAP, the Residential Drug Abuse Program, it's a 9-month intensive therapy. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All the inmates live in a separate unit from the rest of the inmates on the compound. And every single inmate that's in that unit is in the RDAP program. So it's 9 months. It's a peer centralized type of therapy. So it's all peer, it's all about your peers holding each other accountable. And what it teaches you, it's basically this thing called cognitive behavioral therapy. It teaches you that your thoughts determine your feelings determine your actions. If you can change your thought process, then your actions change at the end of the day. Now, why is that beneficial when we're talking about crime? Well, since I've been on the good guy side, I soak up all this information from cybersecurity people, from psychologists, from criminologists, from law enforcement, from ACFE, certified fraud examiners. I soak up all the information that I possibly can, because it all really is interconnected. Here's one of the things that I learned. Back in the 1950s, this gentleman by the name of Donald Creasy, he creates this thing called the fraud triangle. He's trying to determine what causes insider fraud, what causes an employee at a company to go rogue and start committing crime. And he came up with this thing ultimately that was called the fraud triangle. When he first came up with it, it wasn't in a triangle format. Somebody later on said, hey, there's three things. We'll make a triangle out of it and it'll go great. And it did. But what Creasy comes up with is, he says, for insider fraud to take place, three things have to happen. You have to have pressure on that employee. That employee has to be scared of losing their job, angry at management. Maybe their marriage is broken up, but some sort of pressure has to be in place. That employee has to have the opportunity. So you've got pressure, then you've got opportunity. That employee has to have the opportunity to commit that specific type of crime. If the employee doesn't have the opportunity, the crime can't be committed. And then finally, and this is one of the things that really resonates with me, finally, that employee has to be able to justify their crime. If they can't do all three, that insider fraud won't happen. So what's always hit strong with me is that justification. When I was a criminal, and it's from the age of 10 on up through my, when I was arrested and sentenced to prison, I'd always said, for example, I was when the Secret Service found out I was screwing them over and they sent me to jail, and then I get out, and before I go on that cross-country crime spree that ends in Disney World, I'd bonded out of prison, out of the county jail, and I was being interviewed by this New York Times writer by the name of Tom Zeller. And Tom had been flying back and forth from New York to Columbia, South Carolina to interview me while I was working for the United States Secret Service. And no, the Secret Service did not know about that. And yes, they did frown upon that. But Tom, the last time that I spoke to the man, I was in Columbia, South Carolina. We were having dinner and he had brought a photographer with him. And he asked me, the last question he asked me, and I guess the man knew that I was about to take off on the run, but he asked me, he's like, Brett, why did you do it? And I looked at Tom and I was like, Tom, I did it all for Elizabeth. And he looked at me and he was like, God damn it, Brett, at some point, you've got to accept responsibility. And here's the thing, I had no idea what he was talking about. To me, that was why I had done it all. Now, looking back, that's absolutely incorrect. I had used a ton of excuses leading up to that. I had said, well, I did it for my sister. I did it for my family. I did it for my wife. I did it for my stripper girlfriend, Elizabeth. But the thing is I believed every single one of those justifications. And that's what Creasy talks about, is he says, hey, finally, at the end of the day, if this insider, this employee this potential fraudster cannot justify their crimes. If they can't somehow convince themselves that they are a good person, they will not commit that specific type of that fraud, that crime. That today, and it meant me going through this program that I'm talking about today and being associated with the people that I am today and being able to work on the good guy side of the fence. That really resonates with me today because I fully believe that if someone, you know, is a fraudster, is a cyber criminal, an identity thief, I fully believe if they would accept responsibility, if they would just set aside that cognitive dissonance, that faulty thinking, and understand that it's their choice to commit the crime, that there's really no justification for that, that they're choosing it, that they don't have to, but they are. And if they were able to see the damage that they were causing their victims, I don't think we would have a whole hell of a lot of crime that's out there. So that's why I'm really doing this show today, is to talk about that. And it's not just for crime. It's for anything that's out there. If you're in a shitty situation, a shitty relationship or something like that, and you keep saying, you know, everything always goes bad for me. I don't deserve this. I bang, 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 whatever that is. It's what that is. That's an excuse. That's a justification that you're using so that you don't have to act. So going back to this thing called CBT, this cognitive behavioral therapy, I was initially sentenced after my escape. I was sentenced to Big Spring, Texas. So that's out in West Texas, where it gets so hot, I shit thee not, it gets so hot that warnings come on the radio telling you what streets not to drive on because the streets are melted. So I was out there for about 3 years, and it took me about 2.5 years to accept responsibility, to understand that, hey, I didn't do any of this stuff because of wife, girlfriend, family, sister. No, I broke the law. I victimized people because I chose to do that. That was all of my decision to do that. Took about 2.5 years for me to get to that point. After I was at Big Spring for about 3 years, they transferred me to Fort Worth, Texas. And that's where I went through the RDAP program. So the RDAP program, like I said, it's a 9-month course where you're in a separate unit than everyone else on the compound. And you go through this thing of teaching you cognitive behavioral therapy, how your thoughts determine your feelings determine your actions. And I wanted to just kind of go through some of the things that RDAP, I say RDAP, that CBT, because it's actually a CBT program. I wanted to go through some of the things that they talk about and teach you. And the first, one of the big things that they really try to instill in you is that there are core attitudes of this therapy program. So there are things that at your core, inside of yourself, that you should always strive for. Because if you're not striving for that, if you're not attaining these attitudes, the possibility of you doing something bad is pretty damn high. So going through those, and there's eight, there is honesty. And what RDAP and what CBT says is it says honesty. Honesty is the foundation of change, being truthful. Areas that you refuse to be honest in will likely result in your future relapse. So if you can't be honest with people, if you can't tell the truth to people that you're talking to, but also to yourself, that is that either not telling the truth or holding the truth back by remaining silent, that is one of these things that opens up that pathway for you to go back to commit crime or go back into toxic relationships. Or go back into using drugs, because this is a drug program after all, but it opens up that door for that. You have to be honest. You have to, when someone asks you a question, you have to tell them the truth. And it's not even about them asking a question. It's about simply being truthful at all times, being honest. It's about having the second attitude is humility, knowing that you do not rule the world. Being humble and not self-centered. Humility helps you understand that your actions are based on what is right and wrong, not what you can and cannot get away with. Now, for a criminal, I want to tell you, especially for cyber criminals, we have the biggest egos on the planet. And we are not humble folk. We are not. When I got in the drug program myself in RDAP, I was called out many, many times for my lack of humility because I was a pure asshole. I would point at everyone. I would call everyone out. I would not call myself out. And it was a process, and it's still a process today, me learning humility. And I'm doing better. I still think I have a lot of issues with that. But understand that if you can't strive for that humility, whether you're a drug addict, in toxic relationships, committing crime, what have you, if you can't strive for that humility, and if you can't just base your decisions on what is right and what is wrong. Now, we're not always talking about, you know, legal stuff. We're talking about relationship stuff. Here's the thing. If you're honest with yourself, if you're honest with other people, and you have humility to simply go toward what is right and wrong, you're going to be able to know that, hey, I'm in a messed up relationship, or, hey, I need to get off these drugs, or, hey, dipshit, stop breaking the law. Try that one on for size. So that's honesty, humility. The third attitude is called objectivity, not being biased or taking sides. You will learn to focus on others and not just yourself, learning to be unselfish. So I've said this on other interviews. An addict cannot love anything except the thing that they are addicted to. Gambling, toxic relationships, drugs, crime, what have you. That addiction will always come first. But if you're objective, if you're not taking sides, if you're not selfish, then at that point you start to understand that whatever's been causing you problems in your life, and you're able to look at it objectively, you're able to see what the issue is. And you're able to see that, hey, yeah, I may be addicted to cocaine, or I may be committing crime, but guess what? Objectively, nothing made me do that. I chose to commit crime. I chose to, you know, take cocaine up my nostril or smoke it or what have you. So that objectivity is very big. The fourth attitude is called gratitude. So grateful for the opportunity to change, learning to be grateful for the opportunity to change, and toward the people who are willing to help you. One of the things that I found out turning my life around, historically, I've been the guy that I do not ask for help. And that dates back to my childhood. My sister, in one of the interviews I did on the Old Anglerfish podcast, she said that she always thought that someone was going to come and save us. And my response to her was, I knew that no one ever would. And I really think that's one of the turning points of my life, is that statement and that realization. No one can save you but you. But here's the truth. That's bullshit. The truth of the matter is that when I turned my life around, I would not have been able to do that without people out there giving me the opportunity and helping me make that change. Kind of sounds like a Michael Jackson song. Make that change. But here, the thing that I'm trying to get at is that you can make the choice to turn your life around. But if you don't have outside people that are assisting you, that are there for you, that give you that support group and that safety net, the chances of you making that, of succeeding, is very low. And I don't care if that's in crime. I don't care if that's in addictions, whether it be drugs, gambling, what have you. I don't care if it's in relationships. If you don't have someone there that's willing to help you through this, the chances of you being successful is very, very low. So because of that, you need to be objective. You need to be honest with yourself and others. You need to have that humility, the humility to ask for help, to understand that you can't do it yourself. And then the gratitude for someone that's willing to help you, that there's, I'm going to be honest with you, I was able to turn my life around because people helped me, people that I could never, ever repay the kindness and what they went on the line to do. I was a criminal out of prison, and the people who initially helped me put their reputation on the line and took a chance on me. That's something that you could never, ever repay someone, when they're actually putting their livelihood on the line, taking a chance on you. And it happens with me every single day. someone comes and they, you know, I'm well respected now, but still, even now, when I talk to a company, when I give a presentation, when I consult, when I talk to someone who's been victimized, they are taking a chance on me. And I'm extremely grateful for that. So that gratitude really matters. The next attitude is caring, support for those around me. Caring helps provide support for yourself and those around you. One of the things as a criminal, you really don't care about anything but yourself. As an addict, I said that just a couple of minutes ago, the most important thing to an addict is the whatever they're addicted to. That comes above relationships. It comes before love. You can't love anything else except your addiction. So caring works against that. If you're a caring individual, the chances of you being self-centered or selfish, of putting yourself before everyone else, the chances of that happening is really declining at that point. Next one is responsibility. Being responsible for your own actions, the ability to focus on your contribution to a problem rather than looking for someone or something else to blame. So here's the truth of the matter. We as a society are very good about giving people reasons so that they do not have to accept personal responsibility or accountability. You can see it every day in the media. You know, back when a couple of years ago, the media, you know, you had a lot of these riots, a lot of looting that was going on, and you had groups like NPR that said looting was justified, that, hey, they've been, it's systemic in the system. So they were giving the people who were committing, who were making these criminal choices, they were giving them reasons so that they wouldn't have to accept personal responsibility. We saw the exact same thing on January 6th with the people who tried to do the coup at the Capitol. The coup at the Capitol. I like that alliteration. But they were given reasons. Hey, the election's stolen. You can't. The president said to do this. So they were given reasons so they wouldn't have to accept responsibility or accountability for their actions. The thing is, if you can't understand that you are the person that is responsible for your lot in life. It's your decisions. It's your choices. Now, I've said it before in presentations. I'm going to say it again in case I've not said it on my show. When you're a child, you can't help what the adults in your circle are doing. You're going to do what they're doing, period. That's the way this shit works. But when you become an adult, you have the opportunity to change. You can make a choice. You can make a decision. I don't have to follow in the footsteps of my parents. I don't have to continue to engage in crime. I don't have to grow up to be an abusive person. I don't have to use drugs. You have the opportunity to change. But if you can't accept that responsibility, if you can't understand that that decision is within yourself and you're always blaming it on someone else or something else or a system, then what happens? Well, the chances of you continuing to spiral down that path of destruction is pretty damn high. So responsibility matters, because when you are really able to accept responsibility for your life, to understand that your choices have resulted in who you are, where you are, and what's happening to you, when you understand that, that's actually a very powerful moment, because when you understand that you put yourself in that situation, you also understand that, hey, I can get myself out of that situation. So responsibility is absolutely paramount. The seventh attitude is open-mindedness, willing to try something new, accepting feedback about your behavior and different ways of doing things, being open to trying new ways. So that open-mindedness, not just being dogmatic, but just being willing to accept other people's feedback, to understand that, hey, you don't have to have everyone like you. Just being open, you know, not being shut off, being open. That makes a world of difference, because when you're open to you're open not only in the mind, but to opportunities, to a new way of life. It's when you're not open that you continue to spiral down that path of destruction. And then finally, the eighth attitude is willingness. It's a daily effort, willing to go to any lengths for your recovery. I've spoke about this about criminals. You know, it's when I say a cyber criminal, there are three things that are inherent for that criminal to commit crime. I think that it's knowledge, willingness, and then ego. So willingness, what is that criminal willing or not willing to do? Willingness matters, but are you also willing to take the chance to turn your life around. I had a gentleman, let me pull up this comment. He actually responded on episode number 22 of the Brett Johnson Show, and he responded yesterday. And he says, one life and you quit your maximum source of fun. Why for? What is worthier than life having fun using the one in life gift that you have? We're going to be gone anyway. So what he's saying is that, hey, why'd you quit this shit? You know, you were gifted at it. Now, I'll tell you, I don't know who the hell you are that left the comment, but yeah, I was gifted at victimizing people. I was gifted at committing crime, at fraud. I am still extremely gifted at that if I ever wanted to return to that. But that is, once you accept responsibility, once you know that I was the person who put myself in prison. Yeah, the cops arrested me. People told on me. But it was my choices that led to that. I put myself in prison. And I chose to victimize other people. Now, that is not fun. That's never been fun. It's not fun to hurt others, okay? This is these core attitudes of the RDAP program and of cognitive behavioral therapy. If you can simply start to work toward these attitudes, and let's name them out again: honesty, humility, objectivity, gratitude, caring, responsibility, open-mindedness, and willingness. If you can simply work toward those attitudes, just work toward those, I can promise you that whatever bullshit you are going through, whatever is going bad in your life right now, whatever's going wrong, whatever you want to change, whatever you're up at all night with stressed out, anxiety, whatever, I can promise you, if you simply work toward those eight things of honesty, humility, objectivity, gratitude, caring, responsibility, open-mindedness, and willingness, I can promise you that that will change. I can promise you that. I can also promise you that if you can understand that what it takes ultimately is changing your thought process. You know, and let me pull this other thing up so we can go through some of this stuff. There are, it's called cognitive dissonance. It's faulty thinking. And we all suffer from it. We all do. I mean, I don't think that anyone out there does not on the regular suffer from cognitive dissonance. But there are these things called thinking errors. All right. Understanding that the way you think, so think of it as you've got an ABC. You've got an activating event. You've got a belief about that event. Then that belief causes you to act, to do something, to make a choice to do something. And then you have the consequences of that specific action. So, you know, the activating event, maybe you're at home and you've got an argument with your significant other. And that's the activating event. And your belief, and you'll say it to him or her, you always do this kind of thing. Well, that's your belief. That's not, it may be true, it may not be true, but that's your belief. So you say you always do this kind of thing. And then you choose maybe you're angry, maybe you're whatever the hell, you choose to throw a vase through a window or some bullshit like that, like my mom used to do. And then the consequences, whatever they are from there. Maybe you're a man or a woman and you decide that you're going to become violent toward your spouse. And the consequences ultimately are you are in jail at the end of the day. So the activating event, the argument, the belief, you always do this. And then the other belief would be, I have to shut this person up. I don't want to hear this. So instead of disconnecting from that argument, you decide to ramp it up and become violent. And then the consequences are ultimately landing in jail. So we see in that there's this thing called cognitive dissonance or some faulty thinking. Of course, there's some faulty thinking. All right. There's first that idea of absolutes. You always do this. No, you don't. You may often do it. It may seem like you always do it, but there's no such thing as absolute. There's no you know, we talk about the gray areas of life. No one is always a liar. No one is always drunk or on drugs. No one is always committing crime. No one is this absolute, no one is always arguing or trying to stir up trouble, a drama queen constantly, anything else like that. But we hear this all the time, right? You've got to understand that that absolutes, that's a faulty way of thinking. That's this idea of cognitive dissonance. You are not thinking properly at that point in time. There's another one called, and so just go through these thinking errors. And there's a few of them. A list that cognitive behavioral therapy and RDAP teaches you is there's absolutes. You know, you always do this kind of thing. There's the I can't. I can't do that. I can't. Well, you can turn your life around. No, I can't. There's no way I can turn my life around. Well, yeah, there is. That's just faulty thinking. It gives you, it shuts down any opportunity of willingness, of open-mindedness. See what we're getting at with these eight attitudes? So this I can't pops up if you're not working toward these eight attitudes. The rhetorical questions. Well, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I commit crime? Well, why wouldn't I go ahead and use drugs? So rhetorical questions. Awfulizing. You know, my life is so bad. No one's got a worse life than me. Everything always goes wrong for me. So you've got absolutes and you're awfulizing at that point in time. Statements of fact. That's making a statement that sounds factual, but is not indeed based on all of the information that is available. He, she, it statements, blaming. So you're going to blame it on everyone else but your choices. You know, it's society. It's the government. It's everyone's fault but mine. She made me do that. You know, you made me angry. You're making me drink. I had to commit that crime in order to put food on the table. See what I'm getting at? Loaded words. So those are simply, you know, they can be insults. They can be anything that causes emotion, anxiety, stress. The have to, need to, must. I have to do this. I need to get out there. I need to get out there and get my hustle on, man. I need to get out there. I need to make sure I get this done. I need to do this. Well, no, you don't have to. You don't must have to do anything. And then finally, should. And this is something that I think most people engage in all the time. You know, we see that someone is doing something wrong. We view them as an idea of, well, you shouldn't do that. You should be doing this instead. And here's the thing. We have to be able to accept people for who they are, not who they should be. But all of these thinking errors, absolutes, I can't, rhetorical questions, awfulizing, statements of fact, he, she, it statements, blaming, loaded words, have to, need to, must, should statements, every one of those faulty thinking things, if you're working toward those eight attitudes, those eight qualities of CBT. And what are they again? There's honesty, being honest with yourself and others. There's responsibility, taking responsibility for your actions. There's willingness. Are you willing to take the chance to change? Are you willing to accept others' feedback? There's open-mindedness. Are you open-minded enough to take people's feedback? Are you open-minded enough to be honest or to understand that you are the cause of your problems? There's humility. Can you swallow your fucking pride long enough to do the right damn thing? There's humility. There's caring. Do you care about your fellow man or woman or transgender? I don't give a shit who it is. Do you care about your fellow human being? There's objectivity. Can you set aside your prejudices and be objective? Can you do that? And then finally, there's gratitude. Can you be thankful for the blessings that you have or that others are bestowing upon you? If you're working toward those eight qualities right there, then these thinking errors, they will lower significantly. You'll never get rid of all of them. You'll never get rid of all of them. But you'll minimize those simply by working toward the eight attitudes of change. Who would have thought? I mean, this is... Like I said, this is Brett Johnson's show. Somebody called it a support group wrapped in cybercrime veneer. By God, it is today. So walking through that, the thinking errors, absolutes, it's thinking in extreme or overgeneralized ways. The I can't, making excuses for not doing something. Rhetorical questions. Hiding negative thoughts in questions is the definition for that. Awfulizing. The definition is thinking only bad things will happen. Statements of fact, making assumptions without knowing all the facts. He, she, it statements, thinking that other people, events, or things outside of you cause you to feel a certain way. So this is one of the things that my sons, my wife, people who are that I talk to frequently, they get pissed off at me because they'll say, you know, you made me mad. That makes me sad. Well, no, it doesn't now. I did not make you anything. The way that you thought about maybe my comment or someone else's comment or some lot that you've got in life, whatever's going on with you right now, the way that you're thinking about that has caused you to feel the feelings that you are going through right now. And those feelings that you're going through right now will result in whatever action you are going to take. So if you can change the thought process at the beginning, the feelings will subsequently change, and then the actions will change at the end of the day. You got that? No one makes you feel anything. No one makes you mad. No one makes you sad. No one makes you happy or glad. You make yourself that by whatever that thought process is. So if you are going through some bullshit, if you're going through something that's got you stressed out, that's got you angry, understand that's what's causing you to experience those emotions is the way that you framed that event. Remember we talked about that initial event, that activating event. So whatever has caused you, however you framed that, has caused you to be feeling whatever you're feeling right now. All right. I've lost my job. I am pissed off. They had no business doing it to me. That is, they've destroyed me. It's all over. I don't know what I'm going to do. So you've got all these thinking errors that are in line all of a sudden. All right. So I didn't deserve this, whatever that is. All right. But if instead of losing the job, you start to think, well, yes, I lost a job, but I was unhappy in that job. I've been looking for a reason to try another path in life, to try another job opportunity, to try another career. If you start to view it like that, of trying to look at the positives of it, then the resulting feelings change as well. You're not going to experience that anger, that fear, that despair. Yeah, you may be having some disappointment. Who wouldn't? But those feelings, those negative feelings, will be minimized because of the way you change the thought process at the beginning of that specific change. So just understand that. Thoughts determine feelings. Feelings determine actions. Thoughts determine feelings. Feelings determine actions. You change the thought process, the actions change at the end of the day. Kind of interesting. So where else are we? Thinking errors, blaming, finding fault in other people of things. Thinking errors, loaded words, using profane, offensive words that are disrespectful. Yeah, you shouldn't be doing that. I mean, I fucking do it all the time. But I know when to reel it in too. All right. I know that if I'm in a crowd where someone is simply, I don't say things, you know, I'll say shit. Sometimes you'll get a fuck out of me, something like that. But you need to understand that those are loaded words, that they cause people to, once you say that activating event, the people at that point then go on, and because you're using those loaded words, their thought processes result in certain feelings that are sometimes negative, and then all hell can break loose at the end of the day because of that. Thinking error, definition of have to, need to, must, leaving yourself no options, saying need, but really want. I think I mentioned that on Twitter the other day. There is a difference between need and want. I was in prison. I'll give you an example. I was in prison. I was me and Nick Sandifer. He was the treasurer of the Aryan Brotherhood. No, I was never a member, but he was the treasurer of the Aryan Brotherhood. And what you see is when you come into prison, whatever race you are, you're met by that same race at the door. And typically you'll have someone that will meet you and they'll ask you, you know, what are you in for? And then they'll ask you, do you need anything? All right. So this guy came in on the prison bus and he was at his bunk, and Nick, he was at a bunk right next to where we were. And Nick asked him, he's like, hey man, do you need anything? And the guy's like, yeah, man, I really need a shot of coffee. And Nick looks at him. He's like, no, you want a shot of coffee. You don't need a shot of coffee. You need stuff like hygiene, shower shoes, toothpaste, toothbrush, soap, stuff like that, underarm deodorant. Now, do you need anything? And the guy got a little miffed. He got a little pissed off. He's like, no, man, I'm good. So he walked off, and I looked at Nick, and I was like, you know, sometimes motherfuckers just can't be taught. So there's a difference between need and want. You may think that you need that new car. You may think that you need whatever the hell's out there, that shot of whiskey or what have you, but you really don't. You want it. So there's a big difference in that. You need to understand and be able to identify, be open-minded enough, objective enough to understand the difference between needs and wants. See, it all works toward moving toward these eight attitudes. If you're working toward those things, all these negative things in your life start to be minimized over time. All right. So just understand that it's this thing. It's this camera check. It's once you adopt these attitudes. And what are the attitudes? I mean, we're going to drill this shit in today. I had somebody the other day comment that, you know, you don't have to say the same thing 10 or 12 times. Well, you know what? You don't have to listen to the entirety of the show either. You can turn it off if you want to. I don't give a damn. But sometimes it helps to say things over and over. So honesty, responsibility, willingness, open-mindedness, humility, caring, objectivity, gratitude. If you're working toward those things, all that negative stuff in your life starts to go away over time. All right. The reason I say this, and to give you an idea of how that works in my life today, I have absolutely lost friendships because of my honesty in my shows, in interviews, and posts on LinkedIn, in conversations, things like that. I have absolutely lost friendships because of that. I've lost contracts because of that, because you know, a company wants me to say or do something, and I won't, or not say or not do something. You know, just be quiet, Brett. Don't say anything about it. Well, that's not the way that I work. Okay. Or, you know, we're looking at these banks to be clients of ours. So, you know, when you go out there and you say that that's the whitest bunch of people that ever was that's running the top nine banks, they're probably going to frown on us. Well, you know what? That is the whitest bunch of people that I've ever seen. It's like they've got moon tans. You don't see many people of color that are in those positions of power like that. And if you can't say that, you can't call out people in your own industry or call out companies or individuals that are doing wrong, if you're expected to only call out criminals that are doing wrong, something's wrong with that. You have to be honest. So people who think that I'm an asshole, and it's not many, but there are a few people out there who think I'm an asshole that, hey, this son of a bitch will say anything. I say what needs to be said, because I'm working through these eight attitudes of CBT. I'm really embracing those, and I believe in those. I do. I absolutely believe in those. You could ask my two sons. I talk about this stuff constantly, that you are the master of your fate. It's your choice to do things or not, to do what's right or not, to be open-minded, to be objective. Are you objective, or are your emotions getting in the way? Are they clouding your judgment? You have to be able to step aside, step back for a minute, count to 10, do a camera check, look at the environment, look at the activating situation, look at the way that you're handling that, what your thought processes are on that, the feelings that you're experiencing on that, and then backtrack and say, well, you know, hey, yeah, I'm mad, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm upset, I've got a lot of despair going on right now. What's causing that? Well, what's causing that is the activating event. Maybe I was fired, what have you. And I'm framing it in this line of thought, which is causing these emotions to occur. How else can I frame that? So you start to think about it. And when you start to think about it, things start to change all of a sudden. Maybe you put down the needle. Maybe you don't pick up that damn straw that you're snorting the coke with. Maybe you don't go on the dark web and buy a bunch of stolen credit cards or engage in refund fraud or pandemic fraud or whatever the hell kind of fraud that you're going to engage in. So that's what we're talking about today. It's all about choice, right? It's all about choice. It's I made a comment the other day, actually the day before yesterday, on LinkedIn. asking if anyone had ever thought, really thought about why we are experiencing such a surge in scams, in fraud, in cybercrime. And we are. We absolutely are. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. When Shadow Crew gets shut down, we ended with 4,000 members. Fast forward to 2017, Alphabay, largest criminal network on the planet, it gets shut down as well by law enforcement, 240,000 members. Fast forward to 2019, dark web marketplace called Black Market gets shut down, 1.15 million members. All of that pre-pandemic. During the pandemic, fraud exploded because the governments, especially the United States government, decided not to implement any security at all for the space of 6 months, meaning that every fraudster and cyber criminal on the planet, they pivoted towards stimulus fraud, and they banked a lot of money. As a result, the numbers of fraudsters, they really exploded at that point in time. But even now, post-pandemic, we continue to see an explosion in the numbers of fraudsters that are out there. Just a few months ago, we had this thing called the criminal phone. FBI arrested 800 people worldwide. That sounds like a shitload of people until you realize there were actually 3 million users of these criminal phones, these encrypted phones that were being used to do anything from human trafficking to ordering murders to cyber, you know, fraud, financial cybercrime, what have you. There were 3 million people doing it. They arrested 800 of those 3 million. Numbers continue to explode. If you're on LinkedIn, if you're in the fraud industry, you see that the amount of fraud that's occurring within your system, the number of people who are trying to penetrate, who are pinging these systems, numbers that we have never seen before, and they continue to grow. Now, the problem is that, yes, a lot of these crimes are very easy to commit because 90% plus of every single attack uses known exploits. It's not shit it's not zero-day attacks or unknown vulnerabilities. It's stuff that people know about, that they've known about for years, that simply has not been patched or plugged or stopped. Policies, procedures, or tools have not been put into place to stop or mitigate these crimes or attacks. So it's very easy to do that. The consequences, the chances of a cyber criminal, a fraudster, or a scammer being arrested and prosecuted, extremely low. As a matter of fact, there's a UK study right now that says that 1 in 3,000 fraudsters are actually prosecuted and sent to prison. 1 in 3,000. So the chances of getting away without criminal prosecution are extremely high. All right. So ease of crime, ease of commission, lack of consequence. That right there is reason enough that people would commit crime. But that's still not, that does not, to me, justify the numbers that we're seeing. What kind of numbers are we seeing? Well, if cybercrime were a country, cybercrime would have the third largest economy on the planet. China, USA, cybercrime. Millions of people committing it. Millions of people. Third largest economy on the planet right now. So simple ease of commission, simply lack of prosecution, that does not justify the numbers. Even that does not justify the numbers. I think that really what justifies these numbers is, as a society, and this is one of the reasons that you see me consistently calling out companies, calling out the supposed good guys who are screwing up, who are victimizing other people, who are not doing their job. The reason you're seeing me doing that is because we now live in a society that tells people that, hey, it's justified. You know, hey, the problems that you're seeing, they're systemic. You know, you're never going to get out of the area. It's the government that's done this to you. It's the races, the different races of people that have done this to you, and you're never going to be able to get out of that. And whatever that is, it's basically a lot of excuses, a lot of justifications are thrown out there so that the person making the choices does not have to accept responsibility for their own actions or accountability for their own actions. I really believe, because, and companies, you know, companies, the good guys that are out there doing bad, you know, we've got a president that's been in, a former president that's now been indicted. I really believe that we, because of that lack of role models, because of a society that teaches people that, you know, you're not responsible for your own actions because of a society that over the years has been consistent about saying, you've got to look out for yourself. You've got to get ahead no matter what. Because of all this together, it is a systemic, I believe it is a systemic problem. And I think that's what's causing a good portion of the rise, the explosion in cyber criminals, fraudsters, scammers that we're seeing right now. I also believe that, and I said this at the top of the show, I fully believe that if someone could get to the point where they accepted responsibility for their own actions. No, society did not make me do this. No, mommy and daddy not hugging me enough didn't make me do this. What made me commit this crime, I chose to do it. No, I did not have to do that. I chose to do it. I chose to victimize someone. So it's first accepting responsibility. I think that's paramount. And then being able to know the damage that you have caused your victims, because every single day on Telegram, on the dark web, we see a lot of justifications. I'm not stealing from people. I'm not hurting people. I'm hurting the bank. I'm hurting the government. Well, no, you're hurting people at the end of the day. For example, all that PPP fraud, all that unemployment fraud, who pays for that bullshit? People do. The taxpayers do. To give you an idea, the state of California, the unemployment tax was $9 per person. Over the next 9 years, in order to pay for all the fraudulent funds that were sent out, it's going to raise from $9 to $420 per individual. Yes, it's absolutely a crime that victimizes people, but it's also the identity theft aspect of things. The problems that people go through if they needed that stimulus money in order to survive, and you're going ahead and you're stealing their identity and getting unemployment that they needed to pay their bills or to eat, or that PPP loan that they needed to pay their bills or to eat, and now they can't get it because you, some son of a bitch, has stolen this stuff. There are absolutely victims, and I truly believe if we get to the point of accepting responsibility, that where criminals are aware and they know that it's their choice to commit crime, to hurt people, and then see the damage that they're doing, I really firmly believe that those criminal numbers would drop. That's all I got to say about it. This is the Brett Johnson Show, and we're going to close things out on that note. So what do we say as we close out? We say, stay safe, stay secure, stay vigilant. More importantly, understand this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. Thank you for listening. Until next time.